Good morning.
Thank you all for being here. I thank Senator Johnson for attending this morning. It is hard to believe that I've been at this for over 6 years, working on wartime contracting. It has been, in many ways, a roller coaster ride. There have been days that I thought there was no hope, and then there are other days when we were able to get so many of these provisions finally into law that I thought we were really rounding the corner. And today we're here to examine if, in fact, we have turned a corner or if we still have a lot of work to do. We are going to today review the implementation of the wartime contracting reforms mandated in last year's National Defense Authorization Act and to address a couple of current contracting issues that have come up. On August 31st, 2011, the Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan presented its final report to Congress. On February 29th, 2012, Senator Webb and I introduced S-2139, the Comprehensive Contingency Contracting Reform Act of 2012, which was based on the findings and recommendations of the Commission. Just so everyone remembers, Senator Webb and I began in 2007 when we arrived in the Senate as new freshmen working on getting a war contracting commission that could look extensively at issues of how we contract during times of war. The provisions of the Comprehensive Contingency Contracting Reform Act, which were based on the findings of that commission, were incorporated in the fiscal year 2013 NDAA that was signed into law January 2nd of this year. A few of the provisions had reporting requirements that were due earlier this month, and several of those provisions have targets to be met by the end of this year. This morning, we have representatives of the Defense Department, State Department, and USAID here to testify about how their respective agencies are complying with the wartime contracting provisions. Based on the reports that these agencies have made to Congress, they are working to implement these provisions. I'm encouraged by their progress. However, there is still a long way to go. The majority of the provisions in the law passed last year apply only to future contingencies. Unfortunately, they don't apply to Afghanistan now, where we are continuing to hear about contracting problems. I learned just this week that the Defense Department spent millions to construct a building in Afghanistan that has never been used. This facility was built despite the fact that the forward commander said they neither needed nor wanted this facility. In May 2010, almost a full year before construction began. We now have a brand new state-of-the-art building that cost the taxpayers $34 million to build. The worst part is that all indications are we're going to tear it down. We can't even give it away to the Afghanistan government for free because they don't want a building that they will have to spend millions to rewire because it was built to U.S. electrical code. I also recently learned that more than $13 million may have been wasted on a USAID agricultural development contract with a company called Chemonix. The waste alone is bad enough, but the Special Inspector General also found that the contractor failed to cooperate with the audit. Frankly, that's just unacceptable. I will also ask questions about the security of our embassy in Kabul. The subcommittee first held a hearing on this topic in 2009, and I continue to have serious concerns regarding that contract. These examples illustrate why it's so important that contracting reforms passed this year are fully implemented, and our government has learned the lessons, finally, once and for all, of Kosovo, Iraq, and Afghanistan. I plan to continue to hold hearings like this one until that time comes. The Office of Federal Procurement Policy has provided a letter regarding their implementation of the war contracting provisions. I ask unanimous consent that this be included in the hearing record. I thank the witnesses for being here today, and I look forward to their testimony. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's interesting, the couple examples you did bring out that I'd like to reinforce a little bit. The $34 million building, 64,000 square feet. What's just depressing about that is the commanders tried to stop its construction. It was originally proposed in February 2010. By May of 2010, they say we really don't want it. But in February 2011, it was contracted out, and we went ahead and produced it or constructed it at a cost of $531 per square foot. Now, I've done a lot of construction for plants, pretty complex manufacturing structures. We've never had anything that cost $531. We checked with the National Association of Home Builders. The average cost of a home is about $80 per square foot. So, I mean, there's so many problems with that that example that you raised. We'll certainly have questions on that. You also talked about the security situation in the embassy of Kabul. And there is a pretty interesting article that I'd like to submit for the record by the Project on Government Oversight. It's actually a report issued in January 2013. And as you are reading that report, again, this is contracted security and whistleblowers from that contractor that are being fired for raising alarms about the lack of security. And what is alarming to me is, as I'm hearing in this report, the response of the State Department, saying that it takes very seriously the concerns of the Aegis personnel, but at the same time, those people are being fired. It is eerily similar to what we heard in terms of the security around the embassy or the consulate in Benghazi and the resulting tragedy of that. So I'm going to have a number of questions about that situation as well. Madam Chair, I really commend your efforts in holding hearings like this. Our hearing yesterday, we just hear the same problems time and time again, the lack of accountability, the lack of incentives to do things in a cost-efficient manner, and when it comes to talking about protecting our personnel in very dangerous places, it seems like we're going to make the same mistakes time and time again. So this is a very timely hearing, and I'm looking forward to the testimony of the witnesses, and I certainly appreciate you coming here to testify. Thank you.
Thank you, and let me introduce the witnesses. Richard Jenman serves as Director of Defense Procurement and Acquisition Policy. He retired as a Rear Admiral from the U.S. Navy after 30 years of service in 2000. Prior to assuming his current position, he served as Principal Deputy to the Director from 2008 until 2010 and Deputy Director of Contingency Contracting and Acquisition Policy from 2010 until becoming the Director in June of 2011. Patrick Kennedy has served as Undersecretary for Management for the United States State Department since 2007. He's been with the Department of State for 39 years and has held positions including Director of the Office of Management Policy, Right-Sizing Innovation, Assistant Secretary for Administration, U.S. Representative to the U.N. for Management and Reform, Chief of Staff of the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq, and Deputy Director of National Intelligence for Management. Aman Janbani is the Senior Procurement Executive Chief Acquisition Officer and Director of the Office of Acquisition and Assistance at USAID. Before assuming his current position, Mr. Janbani worked overseas as a Supervisory Contracting Officer for USAID. He began his procurement career with the U.S. Department of Defense, where he worked for more than a decade at the Naval Regional Contracting Center in Saudi Arabia and Singapore. It is the custom of the subcommittee to swear all witnesses that appear. I would ask you to stand. And do you swear the testimony that you give before the subcommittee will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God. Let the record reflect that the witnesses have all answered in the affirmative. We will be using a timing system, 5 minutes, give or take. We're not going to be, we may harp on other things. We won't harp on that. And Mr. Jenman, if you would go ahead with your testimony, thank you very much.
So, Chairwoman McCaskill, Senator Johnson, distinguished members of the subcommittee, I welcome this opportunity to discuss the Department of Defense's implementation of wartime contracting reforms. You asked me to address 14 provisions in the National Defense Authorization Act for 2013. Each provision is covered in my written testimony, and I ask that it be submitted for the record.
It will.
The Department has made a number of improvements to operational contract support, or OCS for short, based on independent reviews such as the Commission on Wartime Contracting, the Gansler Commission and various Inspector General reports, as well as the Department's own analysis. From the top down, the Department is committed to ensuring support for our warfighters through contracts that are carefully planned for, executed, and monitored. This applies to the current mission in Afghanistan as well as to future conflicts. The Department established a permanent board to oversee our progress in improving OCS capability. The board identified 10 capability areas requiring improvement and more than 140 individual actions. I provided your staff the entire action plan last week for your review. Also, the Department is engaged in a better buying power initiative to obtain greater efficiency and productivity in our spending. We take seriously our charge to protect public funds. In addition, the Department works with its civilian agency colleagues on federal-wide initiatives, intra-agency topics, and sharing lessons learned. This includes working with Department of State and USAID, who are here with me today. Some improvements in contingency and conventional contracting have required congressional assistance. We appreciate this subcommittee's continued strong support, not only for necessary legislation, but also for our deployed forces, both military and civilian. The Department's focused on meeting the warfighters' current and future needs while judiciously managing the Department's resources and balancing risk. Much has been accomplished, but of course, challenges remain. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today to discuss the Department's implementation of wartime contracting legislation, and I welcome your questions.
Yes.
Madam Chairwoman, Senator Johnson, Senator Ayotte. Thank you for inviting me today to discuss the Department of State's implementation of contingency contracting provisions in the FY13 NDAA, a matter that I know is of particular interest to the Chair. State takes its contracting responsibility seriously and is always seeking improvements. Directly after the enactment of the 2013 NDAA, State formed three working groups to focus on risk assessment for contingency contracting, contracting management, and our acquisitions and contracts management workforce. The results were incorporated into our Section 850 report, which was sent to the Congress last month. The working group found that state structure and processes support our national security mission and that our centralized acquisitions office based in Washington, D.C., and our two regional procurement support offices support our contingency contracting requirements. The working groups continue meeting to advance implementation of the NDAA provisions, and we're working with the General Accountability Office on their Section 850 engagement. The Department continues making improvements to its contracting program. The Office of Acquisitions Management continues to hire contracting staff. We have emphasized increasing the number of contracting officers' representatives in our regional and functional bureaus for day-to-day contract oversight. We have improved COR training and established a COR advisory board to share best practices. State is establishing a contract management office in Kuwait to support our Iraq operations, and this could be a model for future contingencies. State will examine using human resources flexibilities, such as recruitment, retention, and relocation incentives, to ensure expedient hiring for contract oversight functions. As flagged by GAO, State issues guidance to strengthen management of interagency acquisition agreements and is working with DOD on overall coordinating arrangements. Regarding our NDAA sections, State examined its use of SPOT under Section 844. We believe SPOT is the preferred system for tracking personnel under contingency contracts and are working to improve data quality. We're also working with DOD to integrate data from the Federal Procurement Data System automatically into SPOT. We continue using SPOT reporting to Congress with DOD and USAID per Section 847. We are evaluating our risk management processes under Section 846 and are looking at more formally establishing a centralized risk management unit at State. The new responsibilities of the Chief Acquisition Officer under Section 849 have been specifically incorporated into those of State CIO. Per Section 861, we have designated a suspension and debarment official who is not part of either the Office of the Inspector General or the Office of Acquisitions. This SDO is supported by a newly added suspension and debarment program manager who works only on S&D matters. Per the GAO, successful S&D programs have dedicated resources, detailed policies, and a referral process. State has all three, and we have gone from zero suspension and debarments in FY 2008 to three suspensions and 31 debarments to date in FY 2013. Several sections of the bill, namely 802, 852, and 853, promote government-wide changes and need incorporation into the federal acquisition regulations. State is an active member of the Civilian Acquisition Council and is working on these matters as detailed in my written statement, which I hope would be entered into the record.
Without objection, it will be.
Under Section 862, State is working with the Office of Federal Procurement Policy and the interagency in developing standards to ensure continued alignment of our existing contract writing system with any new government-wide data standards that might be developed. Under Section 1273, State will undertake assessments to ensure that a capital project is both requested by the host government and can be sustained by it. Since NDAA enactment, State has not undertaken any capital projects that would trigger the need for an assessment. With regard to private security contractors, I know that the Chair has concerns with PSCs providing security at posts such as Kabul, and I will be glad to answer any questions. The State Department has used contract guards for protection of our facilities and personnel since the 1970s. PSCs are critical to our readiness and capability to carry out American foreign policy under dangerous and uncertain security conditions. We fully appreciate the need for robust oversight of PSCs, particularly in conflict areas. Contractors are operationally overseen and contractually managed by direct hire state personnel. My written testimony describes our oversight message. Currently in Kabul, we have a well-managed, effectively functioning contract that provides security to protect our people and facilities. In conclusion, while we recognize that states contracting organization is organized effectively to undertake both routine and contingency contracting, we know and we believe that we must strive to learn from past practices and to better align contingency contracting, especially with the guidance of the 2013 NDA provisions. The Department will continue to refine its processes, procedures, and strategies to ensure that adequate resources and oversight mechanisms are in place for future contingencies. And I stand ready to answer any questions that you might have, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Secretary Kennedy. Yes, Mr. Giambatti.
Chairman McCaskill, Ranking Member Johnson, thank you for the opportunity to discuss the actions the United States Agency for International Development has taken to implement the contracting reform provisions passed into law in the fiscal year 2013 National Defense Authorization Act. I will briefly summarize my remarks and ask that my full statement be entered into the record. USAID welcomes the subcommittee's continued interest in these matters. Our agency has thousands of personnel working in more than 80 missions worldwide to improve the economic environment, global health, food security, and overall development of these nations in support of U.S. foreign policy. This means that we are often operating in areas of conflict and contingencies. So we as an agency and I personally recognize and support the emphasis on greater accountability, sustainable results, and compliance that the provisions have brought forth. I came into my current position with more than 25 years of interagency contracting experience, including in contingency operations. I started my career with the Department of Defense, and since joining the Foreign Service in 1998, I have served in missions from Ghana to Peru to Jordan, and recently spent 2 years as the supervisory contracting officer in Pakistan. I have personal experience with many of the real issues facing our program offices today, and fully support the intent and spirit of this legislation. Over the last several years, USAID has undertaken an aggressive series of reforms called USAID Forward. I am proud and honored to say that many of our USAID Forward efforts are in line with your legislation. The provisions provide solutions to some of the most important issues that we continue to face in our engagements in Afghanistan and Iraq, and foster a better environment for contingency contracting in the future. In fact, we have proactively implemented many of these reforms over the last few years. The last time USAID appeared before you, we told the subcommittee we were exploring ways in which we could strengthen the independent authority of our agency suspension and debarment official. While our current structure meets the requirements of the provisions, USAID is transferring the duties out of the procurement office to a senior official within the Bureau for Management. Additionally, in 2011, Administrator Shaw issued the USAID Sustainable Guidance for Afghanistan aimed at ensuring programs are sustainable and closely aligned with U.S. and Afghan national priorities. We are conducting regular reviews of our projects and have taken actions to cancel projects where necessary, including some infrastructure road program like the Bamiyan-Dushi Road in Afghanistan. We also have modified some projects midway to increase their sustainable results while preserving the existing investment of American taxpayer dollars. The bottom line is that we are learning from the past and leveraging lessons from Iraq and Afghanistan to build a stronger foundation for effective, accountable contracting practices. Sustainability is undoubtedly one of the greatest challenges we face during a time of war or conflict. However, we as an agency have a core belief that it is imperative for not only contingency operations, but for all of our operations. It is one of the key pillars of USAID Forward. It is also a focus area of the agency's new Senior Management Accountability Review process, in which all new awards at the $25 million level will be validated by an assistant administrator to ensure the project meets several accountability criteria, including a demonstrated commitment to sustainable results. Additionally, the administrator himself will provide the final authorization to make an award at or above $75 million. USAID has also developed, for the first time ever, a corporate-level acquisition and assistance plan that allows us to see all procurements across the agency's worldwide operations. This plan has helped create transparency throughout the agency and has contributed significantly to streamline more effective implementing mechanisms. USAID continues to be a world-class development agency and is proudly taking action to implement reforms to strengthen our contracting practices. With regard to your specific legislation, my written statement details the actions we are taking as an agency to implement them, and I'm happy to address any particular section you like. I want to thank you for this opportunity to discuss these actions and to receive input from you and your staff. We are all working towards the same goals to increasing accountability, sustainable results, and compliance across the spectrum of not only contingency contracting, but all government contracting. Thank you again, and I look forward to our discussion.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Let me start before I begin asking questions and acknowledge that everyone's making progress. I mean, it's these hearings, as you all are painfully aware, from my perspective, are all about making a point and holding your feet to the fire. And so my questions, some of them are going to be tough, but I did want to acknowledge at the beginning of the questioning that we are making progress. It is much better than it was in 2007 in every single one of your agencies. But I have to start with, obviously, the awkward situation that I find myself in, that having been reassured by the Defense Department over and over and over again that sustainability is always considered in, you know, I mean, when we argued with them about what kind of sustainability analysis, oh, I was reassured, oh, we always do sustainability. Well, clearly, we have a brand new building that, the right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing, or even worse, the right hand ignored the left hand, which were the commanders on the ground. Let me give you an opportunity, Mr. Jinman, to explain how in the world this thing got built when the people on the ground were saying, stop, don't do this. We don't need it, and it won't be used.
So I don't have an explanation, and it's very difficult to sit here and say that, at least as it's reported, and clearly we now have a building that's not needed, and I do not know how it will be finally disposed of. I do know the Army has initiated it's called an Army Regulation 15-6 investigation to go through all of the analysis and what it is, and until those facts are actually reported out, until that investigation's done, I don't think the department's in a position to be able to state unequivocally what actually occurred and why and who was accountable. But certainly in the face of being told we don't need this and then proceeding, that just doesn't make sense.
Especially when you look at the time period that passed before the contract was given. I mean, if you get a heads up in May of 2010 that the building is not needed and the contracts are not executed until the following year, it really shows a systemic issue on this. And it's what I've said about SERP and son of SERP. And, you know, as you know, the Afghanistan Infrastructure Fund, where we are doing this, and frankly, we've got the same thing when we look at the Chemonics audit at AID. You know, I think you probably know this without me saying it, that I'm not going to stop on this until I know who it was that failed to read the file or who it was that said go ahead and let the contract without doing due diligence about the necessity of the building. And by the way, the sad thing here is, to most Americans, $34 million sounds like a lot of money. You know what I'm worried about? I'm worried about the people who are making these decisions. This is chump change.
Yes, ma'am.
Who cares about the $34 million? It's only $34 million.
What I do know is over the course of the last 18 months, the theater has done four separate reviews. The Milcon budgets has taken either de-scoped or canceled $1.4 billion worth of Milcon projects. That's somewhere in excess of 100 separate projects. I also know that CSTCA NTMA, the group that does the procurements for the Afghanistan, has taken $2.5 billion, has done a series of reviews, and has taken $2.5 billion out of that project, totally out of that project, and that General Dunford has kicked off a fifth review, once again, of Milcon, just to ensure that we are not doing this. So how this one went through, I can't sit here and give you an explanation.
I'm on the edge of my seat.
Yes, ma'am.
To get this information. And, you know, please explain to everyone that the more quickly we can do this, I think it's pretty important that we come up with an answer to the question, how did this happen, sooner rather than later. Because with every day that passes that we don't know the answer, it makes me very nervous that it's happening in other places.
I am told that the expected due date for the report is somewhere in the next 30 to 60 days to have completed the analysis.
Let me move over to Mr. Giambani. I have read the Chemonics audit, and have you read it?
Sure.
Do you think all the people that work for you have read it?
Yes, ma'am, Chair. I'm pretty sure that.
I worry these audits don't get read. I mean, and that was always something that bugged me when I was doing audits, that. We worked very hard, and one of the performance goals I had when I was an auditor was how do we get people to read them? When I read this audit, first of all, what actions have been taken against this contractor for their failure to cooperate with an audit?
Madam Chair, we are taking the cigars concerns very, very seriously, and we have recently received this audit. The mission is reviewing it very carefully because, again, it is an odd situation that Chemonics that we do business with would not want to cooperate with the auditors. So, Madam Chair, if I could get back to your offices with your office to understand the case very, very to read it and assess it and understand this situation, because we are very concerned about this, and it just if I may, so it doesn't pass the common sense test at this point.
Well, and I want to make sure that as we look at, and I'll spend more time on this in the second round about the systems that we're trying to put in place in terms of bad performance by contractors, debarment and suspension, that a failure to cooperate in the audit needs to be part of a bad performance. It needs to be taken into consideration as to their future eligibility for contracts. And the other thing I want to drill down on in this particular contract is really the $64 question about that contract, and that is, I would like to know from your agency, how much money have we spent trying to get the Afghanistan people to quit growing poppy over the last 20 years? How many billions of dollars have we spent trying to move them off poppy? And what are the performance metrics in that regard? How much success have we really had? And I'm not really sure how building public parks gets them off growing poppy, which was part of this contract. You know, I get distributing wheat seed and fertilizer is. I get, you know, building an agricultural center and teaching them ways to make money off an agricultural economy other than poppy. But I really have, you know, at what point do we throw in the towel? And I bet if we take a look at the amount of money we've spent trying to get them off poppy over the last 20 years, I think probably if we look at the numbers, I hope I'll be surprised that we've had success. But I think this may go under the headline of, you know, how long will we hit our head against this brick wall, much to the detriment of the American taxpayer.
Madam Chair, I would like to get you the right numbers, and if I may get those numbers for you for the record, I would like to do that.
Okay, we will follow up on that. Senator Johnson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ginman, you did realize that we were going to be asking about that $34 million building, correct?
Oh, yes, sir.
Did you make any phone calls prior to this hearing to get prepared to answer the question?
Yes, I did.
What did you learn? Other than you were just going to take another 30 to 60 days.
Well, so I did learn there was an investigation ongoing. The findings of what was in that investigation I do not yet have. They've not been published.
Why does it take so long to get to the bottom of something that an industry, you know, trust me, if somebody built a $34 million building and I told them not to build it and it still got built, I would know who made that decision very quickly. I'd know it within a day. I know within a few hours. Why is it so impossible to get questions in the government?
Having been a part of a Navy JAG manual investigation for a $400,000 embezzlement in a dispersing office, it took us about 30 to 60 days to go through and actually go find the individuals. Many whom had left the ship to go be able to go back through the whole thing, get all that. So many of the people, I'm sure, that they're now trying to figure out, where are they now, who are they?
There's a chain of command for this, correct?
Sir. Yes.
Okay, we'll get into that later. What we have is a basic lack of accountability in the government. And that's why it's so out of control. I think, quite honestly, David Axelrod was right. It's too vast, and that's a problem. Mr. Kennedy, talk about accountability. Prior to September 11th, 2012 terrorist attacks in Benghazi, did you at any time review the March 28th, 2012 or July 9th, 2012 cables from Ambassador Kretz and Stevens requesting additional security? Did you review those cables?
I believe I did, Senator. I don't have my Benghazi material with me, but I
recollect. You read those. Okay. Did you discuss those requests with anyone? Particularly, did you discuss those with Secretary Clinton, Cheryl Mills, Deputy Secretary Nides, or Deputy Secretary Burns?
Yes,
so you, those cables and that information, those requests for security, stopped with you?
They went no further. We reviewed them, Senator. I always have extensive discussions with my colleagues in the Diplomatic Security Service. If matters rise to the point where we feel that we cannot mitigate the risk based upon the intelligence that is available to us, we act.
But again, you took that responsibility on yourself then to deny those requests for additional security, even though we knew the security situation was deteriorating.
First of all, Senator, the request in several of those cases, in those cables, if my recollection is correct, and again, I don't have them in front of me, we're talking about security in Tripoli. In Tripoli, not in Benghazi. We reviewed the situation very carefully, and as I said, if we cannot mitigate the risk, just as we did in Damascus, Syria, we will close the post and move on. I will be glad to pull those cables as soon as I get back to my office.
We'll submit them for the record. On April 19th, 2012, the State Department responded to those requests. This cable informed Embassy Tripoli that the department would continue to withdraw security despite the ambassador's request. Did you at any time review or approve that cable, the April 19th cable that, by the way, bore Secretary Clinton's signature?
Again, Senator, though that cable, if my recollection is correct, regards Tripoli, sir, our embassy in Tripoli, not the temporary mission facility in Benghazi.
In addition to the December 11th, memo, which basically said that the State Department did want to maintain a presence in Benghazi. Did you at any time review, authorize, or direct the deployment or redeployment of diplomatic security agents in Libya prior to the September 11th terrorist attack?
No, sir. I did not withdraw any diplomatic security. I never directed the withdrawal of any diplomatic security agents.
Did you at any time communicate or confirm to the Defense Department that the State Department would not be needing the SST after August 2012, and if so, when?
I did, sir. The SST was a Tripoli-based detachment that had been sent into Tripoli when we went into Tripoli. It consisted of 8 shooters, in effect, plus explosive ordnance detection people, aviation experts, communications experts, medical experts. Over the course of our standing up the embassy in Tripoli, no relation at all to Benghazi, in the process of standing up our embassy in Tripoli, the State Department replaced those individuals with State Department personnel. We had sent our own medical personnel. We had sent in our own
communications. We'll talk about why we're using State Department rather than military personnel for those types of situations. What is the current status of the employees named in the Accountability Review Board report, specifically Eric Boswell, Scott Boltrowitz, Charlene Lamb, and Raymond Maxwell?
They are on administrative leave.
And being paid?
Yes, sir.
Do we know what their next assignments are going to be?
No, sir, we do not.
Were you fully aware of the deteriorating security situation in Benghazi?
I read the material, Senator, but there was no intelligence generated by either the State Department or by any other of our partners in the U.S. government agency, DOD or the intelligence community, that directed a threat of the nature that appeared in Benghazi. There was a rocket attack. There was a car bomb.
Why would we actually ramp down the security in Benghazi when the people on the ground were asking for additional security? Why would we do that?
Senator, we did not ramp down the security in Benghazi. The examples you referred to early, particularly the SST, were personnel assigned to the embassy in Tripoli, not to the temporary mission facility in Benghazi. So we did not remove people from Benghazi.
What is the criteria the State Department uses in contracting out security versus using U.S. military?
It depends upon the host nation approvals. It depends upon funds availability. It depends upon the mission sets that are required.
You know, during the Foreign Relations Committee hearing, when we were questioning Secretary Clinton, there were certainly accusations that one of the problems in Benghazi is the funds just simply weren't available. I mean, it is true that if the State Department requests security from the military, they will provide that security, and it doesn't cost the State Department a dime, correct?
That depends, Senator. Some military support is provided on a reimbursable basis, and some support is provided on a non-reimbursable basis. It depends on the situation. Sometimes we pay, sometimes we don't.
What would have been the case in Benghazi?
I don't know, because there was no request.
You never requested it, even though the security situation.
There was no request for military personnel in Benghazi.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
I want to thank the chair and ranking member for holding this important meeting. I want to thank very much the witnesses for being here today. Mr. Gingman, let me just start with particularly contracting in Afghanistan and Section 841. Provisions. Senator Brown and I know you've worked on this issue very closely, pushed to get the no contracting with the enemy provisions in, because one of the issues we've had in Afghanistan, as I understand it, has been that some of the money was flowing into the hands of insurgents. Is that right? And how can you describe for me how 841 has been used effectively to cut off funds to insurgents? And then again, Senator Blumenthal and I now have, after a meeting I had with Major General Longo in Afghanistan in July, now have provisions that will extend these authorities to the Department of State and USAID. So I certainly will be asking both of you about that, and also making sure that we can drop the amount from the threshold from 100,000 to 20,000. So can you talk to me about this issue? And I know that this is a very important issue to me, and I'm hoping that we will pass this legislation to further enhance these authorities.
So it was getting the legislation, I think, 2 years ago now was
right.
important to us. We have it has been used 11 times, 10 times with subcontractors and one time with a prime, to a total of currently, I believe, $31 million. We have looked at both the legislation, your bill that was submitted, and then the revised Senate bill that was put out. And provided view statements. We're basically in agreement with the legislation. We did offer, and we have worked with your staff to improve it. I would say I have now read through the current Senate provision, and again, from my personal perspective, since we have not provided a department view statement, I'm in agreement with what it says and where it goes. I would like to continue to work with your staff. I think there is one particular phraseology that limits our ability to, in fact, void. It deals with head of contracting activity and who has the authority. But other than that, we put in legislation asking for 841 and 842. I would also add is important to us in being able to make it go, the access to records. The Task Force 2010, in order to be able to do the analysis and the forensic work they do, has got to be able to get to the subcontractor records, and Section 842 gives us that authority.
Right.
So not only do we need your bill, but we also need Section 842 extended as well.
So let me just ask certainly Secretary Kennedy, as well as Mr. Dajabani, I apologize in pronouncing your last name. These provisions that Senator Blumenthal and I have introduced, essentially what they flow from is that understanding that money, taxpayer dollars, are flowing to insurgents and our enemies, and that the traditional contracting rules that may work well in Washington, that you need greater authorities to cut off these funds sooner, particularly in areas where there are obviously wartime situations, but also other contingency situations around the world. So, Mr. Kennedy, have you, I would like to ask you what your position would be on extending these authorities to the State Department, because it seems to me, when I look at what the SIGAR has said, they have said that it is important, as well as the Commission on Wartime Contracting has identified this as an area where you also should have this authority to cut off funds sooner. So what's the State Department's position on this?
I've not seen the exact nature of the legislation. I know my colleagues are meeting with your staff, Senator, but I don't want one penny of U.S. government money to go to any terrorist, and therefore an independent grant of authority to the Secretary of State to be able to cut off a contract of ours where it is determined that money is going to terrorists, I totally and completely support that. I can add, since a year ago, because of parallel legislation coming that came in one of our appropriations bills and in one of the titles of that, we've been running pilot vetting programs of this nature both in five countries and a separate program in Afghanistan. So we're on this. But as you say, the ability to cut off a contract immediately, if you gave me that authority, I would gladly take it.
And would you also like to comment with regard to USAID, what their position is? I don't remember the individual I met with, but when I met with Major General Longo in Afghanistan in January, there was also a representative of USAID there. And I apologize for not having his name right now, but he said to me that this was just as much an issue for USAID, particularly of making sure that taxpayer dollars didn't get in the wrong hands.
Thank you, Senator Ayotte. USAID agrees that preventing funds from going to terrorists is, of course, the highest priority for us. And that is the reason we have such a robust vetting system in Afghanistan. This administration is still reviewing your legislation and does not have a formal position on it yet. We believe that we do have strong authorities in place currently, and we would like to examine the legislation more to be able to to understand the differences between the authorities that we currently have. However, we're looking forward to working with your staff and on the legislation, Senator Ayotte.
Well, do you vet existing contractors and existing subcontractors, USAID?
We do in Afghanistan.
And do you compare it to known intelligence with insurgents?
There's a very rigorous process, Senator, that we go through.
Well, if it's so rigorous and you think that you have the authorities you have now, then why did the Commission on Wartime Contracting find that Afghan subcontractors on a USAID community development program in Kunar province were paying up to 20% of their total subcontract value to insurgents for, quote, protection, and that USAID Inspector General estimated that over $5 million of program funding was at risk for falling into insurgents' hands? In fact, one of the recommendations that comes from the Wartime Commission on Contracting is that there be greater authorities, given not only that DOD has requested, but this also apply across the State Department and USAID. So I find it hard to believe that you have the authorities you need right now to address this problem.
Senator, we'd like to know particularly what kind of impact this will have on what we are currently doing, and if it is an additional tool that we'll be able to use, and we do not have those authorities, we would gladly go along with it, but we'd like to look at the differences between the authorities right now.
I just want to correct, it was the SIGAR who said that, not the Commission on Wartime Contracting, but the principle is the same.
Yes.
There seems to be a real urgency. I know my time is up, but the fact that you would come to this hearing and not be able to have reviewed this legislation, which has already been incorporated in defense authorization, has been pending for a while. We have been communicating with your staff about this very much concerns me, that you would not want the authority to cut off funds to our enemies. So I just feel like to not come to this hearing and have an answer for me that you have a viewpoint on this, it really bothers me. So I will be following up on this, and I expect an answer. I'll be submitting a question for the record, and I'd be shocked if you didn't want this authority.
Senator, I would like to say again that we do have a wide variety of authorities at our disposal right now. We've been using them quite considerably for many, many years, and we may want this in our toolbox. It's just that we're looking at it, and we would work with your staff. Thank you very much.
Senator Coburn.
Thank you for having this hearing. Mr. Gudinman, explain to me how we got in the problems with Camp Leatherneck. Would you kind of walk me through how we built a base the Marines didn't want, and they three years prior to its completion had communicated that, and yet we continued to do it? I want to be taught, please, so I can understand what happened.
So, Senator, as I said before, I mean, I don't know all of the details. I do know that an investigation has started, at least as the SIGAR letter to the Defense Department reads. Certainly in 2010, a Marine general said, I do not need this building. As Senator McCaskill said in her opening remarks, construction started in 2011, I believe, was completed in 2012. At least on the face of it, I have no ability to sit here and give you an answer on how that occurred or why it occurred. I do know that I need to let the investigation run its course and understand all of the details, so that we can determine, as Senator Johnson said, who in fact made the decision and why did it occur. At least from my perspective at the moment, it defies logic.
Okay. One of my observation, having done this for a number of years now, is we get hung up on process, which is important, but we don't look at outcomes. Do people in the Pentagon or at USAID or at the State Department, is there someone in any of those three organizations when something is obviously going in the wrong direction that has the authority to say stop? Maybe not a permanent stop, but stop. Let's stop and where is that in the Pentagon? Where is that Department of State, and where is that at USAID?
I'll at least take a shot from a DOD perspective.
Thank you.
I would like to think from a chain of command that anybody who's in that particular chain of command and any decisions made, if they think it's wrong, has the ability to say stop. Don't do that. I can tell you, at least from a contracting perspective in the areas for which I'm expressly responsible, or the person who held my job before Mr. Assad and who's now the director of defense pricing, when we find contracts that clearly are inappropriate, we do say stop. I believe Mr. Kendall, in his role as AT&L, the Undersecretary of Defense for AT&L, has said stop on a variety of occasions. So I think, it's a leadership issue. Do we make mistakes? Oh, certainly
sure,
we make mistakes.
I'm not critical of mistakes being made. Everybody
right,
does that.
So, well, some of them you got to wonder. It's much like fraud. We have the recent newspaper articles where we just sentenced the individual to 20 years. At the end of the day, we attempt to have separation of power. So the person who's got the requirement, the person who places the contract, the person who oversees the contract, and the person who
pays it
are in fact separate. From time to time in any number of areas that we wind up collapsing those, and it increases the risk when we do so. When people do not follow an ethical compass, bad things are going to happen. And hopefully we catch it. I think the IG, the SIGAR, the DOD IG certainly have helped us find those. And when they do, I do think we take action. From my standpoint, sir, it's a question of leadership and the people that are in those positions when they find the things, if they have the power to say stop or at least take a pause and say that I believe that we, in fact, do that.
Any comments from you?
If I could... Senator, we also have multiple points in the State Department. If you look at our command structure overseas, an ambassador, a deputy chief of mission, the management officer, which is the sort of the senior operating officer, if any of them see something that's going wrong, they certainly have the authority to pause the situation and then refer it to Washington. And in Washington, there's the executive director, the chief administrative officer, the bureau, deputy assistant and assistant secretaries, and me. And so if we get all the time material that comes in from an ambassador saying we were going on a direction, the situation has changed politically, economically, structurally, we need to not do something that's proposed. And they send in a justification, and unless there's some overarching argument that they are not aware of, we stop them. We make changes in our program plans all the time when the circumstances that hopefully said that this is the right decision in the first place, then we make changes, sir.
Sir, I'm very, very passionate about this. And when I was in Pakistan for the 2 years that was posted there, the Inspector General came to me and they mentioned they had a situation. All I did was I looked at the information, and there was no doubt in my mind that project had to be ended. And I ended it right there. I went to the mission director. I told him the reasoning behind it, and it was terminated. That's how serious we take this situation,
right,
sir.
Well, let me follow up. We've built a couple hospitals in Afghanistan through USAID, and the whole goal is so that they'll be able to sustain them. But the cost to run these hospitals is about four or five times what the cost is to run what they're replacing. How does that fit with a model of sustainment when they're not going to have the funds to continue to run those hospitals?
Dr. Coburn, regarding these two hospitals, I have been briefed on them, and my understanding is that the Ministry of Health has, in writing, have told us that they are going to fund these two hospitals for them to be sustainable. That is that's the information that we have currently.
All right. So let's assume that's right. The question I would have in terms of health care for the Afghans is, not making the same mistakes we make in our country. And so if we add sophistication, one of the things Dr. Shaw, I think, has been so great at is downgrading requirements so that we meet needs, but we don't necessarily meet them the same way we meet them here, whether it's resuscitating babies or whatever it is. So we've designed infrastructure for the Afghanis at a level that kind of goes against what he talked about in terms of philosophy there. So we're building two new institutions there that it's from somewhere in the Afghani government. They're going to be stealing money from somewhere else to maintain a hospital at our level of expertise rather than at the level of expertise that they need. How do we get so crosswise with what Dr. Shaw wants to do in terms of meeting needs but not doing it under the level of sophistication that we do? That's the reason these are going to cost that much.
Sure. These, again, our project design process that we go through is rigorous, and we make sure that all of the criteria necessary in this project designs are incorporated, from sustainability to cost effectiveness, and all of our projects go through that process. So I will be glad to look into this matter and get you more information for the record, but I would stand by the project design process we go through, which is very, very robust and incorporates all the necessary, like sustainability and risk assessments, and all of that is being done throughout that process.
Well, I know I'm over time, and I apologize, but there is a problem in terms of sustaining these two hospitals, is there not? There is going to be a problem, even though they may have committed to pay for it the first year or two. The fact is there's going to be a problem. So if we have a rigorous standard in terms of sustainability, and yet there's a problem with sustainability, either there's not a problem with sustainability or there's not a rigorous standard. And that's my point, because I think one of the great things Dr. Shaw brings to the USAID is practical common sense on trying to accomplish outcomes rather than get tied up in the mess of requirements. Let's treat people's illness and prevent disease rather than transfer our cost structure to them. So I yield
Dr.
back.
Dr. Coburn, in fact, just to follow up on what you mentioned about Dr. Shaw, what we've implemented just the last week is an accountability policy whereby all assistant administrators have to review all requirements that go above $25 million to make sure that the seven qualifying factors, which sustainability is one major part of it, is included in those requirements. And Dr. Shaw himself will be reviewing anything above the $75 million. As you said, this is very important to us. Thank you, sir.
I'm going to try to go through in a fairly quick fashion, and I'll take another round if I need to, various sections of the war contracting reforms that have been enacted into law and ask some questions about them. I'll start with Section 844. All of you are using the SPOT database, and I try to always not speak in acronyms, but bear with me when I talk about that acronym. We've done hearings on SPOT, and it's the other, I forget the acronym, it's five letters and ends with next generation. What is it?
FPDSN.
There you go. I knew you could speak the language. It's required if you're at the Pentagon. When we've looked at this, the SPOT's been really underutilized and very inaccurate. So let me ask all of you some very quick questions. Do you believe you have the capability now to collect and report on personnel and contracts on any given date? Mr. Genman?
Yes.
Mr. Kennedy?
Yes.
Yes.
What is the total number of contracts you've entered into, Mr. Genman?
So from October 12 through May 13th, we've done 207.1 thousand actions in Afghanistan and Iraq to a total of $7 billion. It was 1,293 transactions in FY12 to a total of $18.2 billion. I mean, I can, at least for the state.
I'd like to have that document. It looks like you've got it laminated for me. Thank you.
I am happy to share it with you.
And so you can also give me the value of those contracts. Can you give me the total number of contractor personnel you have right now?
I think the actual personnel I have was through April.
And what is that number right now?
Today in Afghanistan, this is through April, 107,796.
And do you have total number of security personnel?
17,993.
And how about contractor casualties?
I do not have that on this list. We have in fact modified SPOT so that it can account for casualties, both wounded and killed. That particular part of the database is probably the area that we still need the most work to get its quality and its state of capability up.
I don't think anybody realizes that your testimony just now, in my world, balloons should have dropped from the ceiling. Because when I started in this, no one knew any of that. So that is a really good sign. Now, what we do with that becomes even more important. If once we get reliable data, then all the excuses about a failure to oversee kind of become even more lame. How about Secretary Kennedy? Do you have the same kind of data available to you?
I brought our FY11 and FY12 totals with me, Senator. Okay. I'll be glad I can easily gin up a FY13 to date and send you. But I didn't bring a snapshot today. But we can hit the machine and make it talk to us. But I can give you FY11 and FY12s.
Broken out by security personnel versus contractors?
For example, in FY12, the total number of contractor personnel for the Department of State in Afghanistan was 1878, and 809 were performing security functions. Okay. And I also have those for Iraq.
And AID?
Global Acquisition Assistance System. This is how we award all of our requirements in the agency. 80% of all the funding goes through this mechanism, and it has direct interface with FPDSNG and the FADS. The FADS collects all the assistance data. And, Madam Chair, we'll be glad to provide you all those numbers, including the number of personnel for the record.
Section 846, this is the requirement that you do risk assessments and risk mitigation for contractor support, including those functions closely associated with inherently governmental functions. Even though it's not required at this time, have you performed the risk assessments for Afghanistan? Mr. Jinman.
So at least as you ask that question, I don't think I can tell you we've done a risk assessment. We do routine risk assessments with the plans on going forward when people are looking at, do I do this through contract, do I do it with civil servants, or do I with military? As those plans are being put together in theater, yes, they review for risk.
And are you all in the process of preparing for Section 846 where you will have that risk assessment?
So at least the two sections of 846 is, at least as I understand them, the first piece is as we're doing planning to consider risk, and we do that today. I can't do this off the top of my head. It is covered in the CJCSM 4301 as an instruction that talks to how we do planning and putting those plans in it, risk assessments is covered. The second half is when we go in, so that's one just in the plan, and the other is when we go into a contingency operation within the 60 days to have done a risk assessment, and we will do that as well.
You know, and this is really a kissing cousin to Senator Ayotte's legislation and language that we've tried to adopt in the NDAA this year moving forward based off your legislation, because if you do the right risk assessment, you don't end up having to pay off the bad guys, because you make a determination that we're going to be, in fact, enhancing our enemy if we try to do this particular project in this security environment. I mean, time after time, if you look at the failures, it has been because they have, and by the way, the can-do attitude of the military and AID and the State Department is something that we're all proud of as Americans. There's nothing that we, quote unquote, can't do. On the other hand, if we think we can build a highway through the middle of the territory where everything is controlled by the bad guys, and we think we're going to do that without getting contractors shot, without paying off the Taliban, that is a dumb mistake. And we have done that with a highway in Afghanistan. And so let me ask you, Secretary Kennedy, what about the risk assessment from your perspective? I think that highway, I can't remember if that's defense or state. Which one is it? It's state.
I'll have to go back and check. I'm not aware that we don't know.
It's AID. Okay. Not you. It's him.
All right. I miss a lot of things. I haven't missed a highway recently.
Neither has anyone else, by the way.
3 points, ma'am. Vetting. We have been engaged in a pilot program both in Afghanistan and in 5 other countries in an extensive vetting operation. So we are piloting that right now, and it's been in place about a year now. We have an office that does vetting in 6 countries as part of including Afghanistan. We have put into place a programmatic request for contracting services, a template that people must do, which I think goes to your point, coupled with when the NDAA passed, one of the working groups we did is set up a contracting risk assessment organizational briefing structure, and we are working through that right now so that should we be faced with the State Department having to go into a contingency operation in Xanadu or Shangri-La, we will use a structure like this. My plan is to set up a small unit responsible for this.
And Mr. John Abani?
In 2010, we basically had the A3 initiative, which was implemented in Afghanistan. It's broken down into 3 different areas. In terms of award mechanisms, we are utilizing awards that provide the most visibility on project costs. For example, cost reimbursable contracts, and we're limiting the subcontracting to 2 levels only. We are conducting the partner vetting. We have a very robust partner vetting system in Afghanistan. And in addition to that, regarding the financial controls, which are very important, we aim to audit 100% of all locally incurred costs as extra measures to identify fraud, waste, and abuse.
I don't mean to cut you off because I've gone over my time and I want to give my colleagues a second round, and we're going to have to start votes here in 20 or 25 minutes. Here's what I'd like from all of you. I don't quarrel that you all are beginning to put into place the systems that would try to embrace what we're trying to get at in the war contracting reforms. I get it that we're doing councils and we're doing working groups and we're doing regs and we're doing, you know, all of that. And, you know, I know it is important, but sometimes it feels like blah, 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 blah. And so what I would like to hear from all of you is I need you to try to find a project you've stopped because of risk assessment. I need you to bring to me some place where somebody was going to build something or do something, not because of sequestration, not because we cut your money, but because based on a risk assessment, you decided, you know, we're going to have to pay off the bad guys to do this, or there's no way they can sustain this, or this is a bad idea because, you know, a water park in Iraq, you know, which is now crumbling, and, you know, or the power grid in an area that's going to get blown up. I need some success stories here. I need you to tell me some places you've done that. And I will promise you this. If you can bring me some success stories where you've cut off projects because you've appropriately evaluated both risk and sustainability, I will make you the stars of my website for as long as you want to be up there. I will herald you, and you know, I will actually send you balloon bouquets. They won't drop from the ceiling. But that's what we're looking for here. We're looking for a sense that all of this work is resulting in a change of culture. And if we don't get that change of culture, I mean, I got to tell you guys, you're going to be here every 6 months until Missourians kick me out of this place, or I decide I've had enough. And at this point, I'm not sure which is going to come first. So, and I will now turn it over to Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to go back to security contracting, because I have to admit, particularly in war zones, it's always really puzzled me why we wouldn't use the finest military force in the world in those individuals. So both for Mr. Gidman and Secretary Kennedy, do you have a metric in terms of what the cost is for using U.S. military personnel versus contracting those security forces? Mr. Gidman. I mean, cost per person, cost, you know, is there some metric?
I don't have that off the top of my head to be able to say a cost per metric. The combatant commander, you know, makes his decisions on when do I want, you know, do I want to use a soldier, a sailor, airman, or marine standing a post at a gate that's interior, or do I want to do that with a contractor?
When we really take a look at the cost of that, though, I mean, is from the Defense Department standpoint, in terms of us having to deal with all these deficits and the cost of these things, wouldn't we make the decision based on, you know, this is costing us two or three times to contract that service versus using the finest among us, the U.S. military personnel? We don't even look at that?
I don't honestly know the answer to the question.
Secretary Kennedy, how does the State Department evaluate that?
I did run some numbers, I'll admit, I'm not going to cite.
That's fine. I like ballparks.
They're ballparks. We are currently at a number of the high-threat posts that the State Department has designated a principal concern. We're spending about $87 million on contracted security. If we replaced, and that includes American and local staff, if we replaced that $87 million entirely with contractors, it would be $4.8 billion if we went from a mix of Americans and contractors, $4.8 billion. If we use the military, and I have not had a chance, this is data that publicly available, the cost is either $3 billion or $9 billion. And the distinction is the military has a planning structure, and I defer to my colleagues, that for every soldier who is engaged, there's also two other soldiers who are coming off of mission and going into retraining or in prep to take the mission. So that, in fact, you have three divisions, one just come out of Iraq, one in Iraq, and one getting ready. So you can see the difference between $86 million and $3 billion for the military is a serious fiscal consideration.
I have to admit, this doesn't make much sense to me, and both Dr. Coburn and I are having accounting background. So I would suggest we really need a pretty detailed evaluation and studying in terms of the cost of contracting versus using military personnel.
Senator, could I add just one thing? There is a general accountability report on this matter, which I did not bring with me,
okay. But
I will be glad to get to you and the committee staff the citation for the General Accountability Report.
Secretary Kennedy, have you seen this January 2013 report from the Project on Government Oversight on Kabul Embassy security?
Yes, sir, I have.
Were you disturbed by the report, as disturbed as I was?
I'm disturbed by anything that I read, and then I go and check the facts. And I am much less disturbed than I was because the material that they reported, I find to be sensationalized, if I might use that word. And I'd be glad now or at your convenience or with your staff to go through, in effect, paragraph by paragraph.
Okay, well, we don't have time here. I'd appreciate it. You know, come on over to my office, and I'd like to walk through. Iran operation was a continuous shift. And I'm very sensitive to how you can work individuals so they're effective. And in this report, they're talking about the contractor. Their guards were working 72 hours per week when the State Department's guidelines would be 36 to 42 hours per week. I mean, right there, that concerns me if that is true. Would you dispute that?
I absolutely dispute that.
Okay.
And if I could add one just contextual matter with your permission, Senator.
Sure.
Our embassy in Kabul is, as you correctly state, under very high threat. There have been two direct attacks on our embassy compound in Kabul during the tenure of this current contractor. Both of those attacks were rebuffed, and the contractor, along with the diplomatic security colleagues there, performed superbly.
Okay.
And so part of it is the proof is in the pudding. We were attacked, and we warded off those attacks with no injuries to U.S. government personnel on our compound.
Okay. Well, again, I would appreciate sitting down and talking with you, because this is very disturbing, particularly in light of Benghazi. And by the way, I recognize you weren't ready to talk about those cables,
but I'll be.
Just to correct the record, all three of those cables do mention specifically Benghazi. They're not just about Tripoli. It's about the temporary duty diplomatic security corps.
But we did not. I'll be glad to come up and, again, Senator, go over those with you or your staff, because the cables have both Tripoli and Benghazi in them. Tripoli asked for certain things. Benghazi asked for certain things. And we met those requirements.
Who did make the decision to ramp down security in Benghazi, though? I mean, where did that decision... Where was that made?
There was no decision, Senator, to ramp down security in Benghazi.
Well, certainly not to keep the SST, the security support team,
that was
withdrawn.
That was a Tripoli-based outfit that was never assigned to Benghazi, nor was it ever proposed to the State Department or anyone else that unit be shifted from Tripoli to Benghazi.
Who made the decision never to fully ramp up the five requested temporary duties, diplomatic security personnel?
There were a request for five in Benghazi. The request from the department was, give us your needs assessment. What will those five individuals do? The needs assessment came back. We would like three diplomatic security special agents. We want one driver, and we want one which is we call crypto guard. For the crypto guard, we sent out an information technology professional, and we got drivers. So what they wanted was three security officers plus two others. And we had three security officers there to meet their request, Senator.
Just one final question, because I've heard this rumor. Is it true that Secretary Clinton's certainly had a goal of setting up a permanent presence in Benghazi, and that was one of the things she talked to Ambassador Stevens about before giving him the job? And did you ever talk to her about that?
I had one or more conversations with the secretary, and there was no decision had been made. I saw that same report that you did, Senator.
Maybe not a decision, but was there a desire to do so?
There, no decision had been made. But the point is, when Chris Stevens was there, the fiscal year was ending in 19 days. There is no way in the bureaucracy, both of the State Department and our requirements for congressional notification when you establish a personal a permanent post or reprogram money. There was no way that was going to be done.
But again, no decisions made, but did you ever talk to Secretary Clinton about setting up a permanent presence in Benghazi?
That was obviously an option, but there had no decision had been made either.
But you did discuss that with Secretary Clinton.
I had one discussion about this is whether to continue the temporary operation there.
Okay.
We continue the temporary operation. That was the decision made at that time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Certainly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate your passion for these issues of contracting in Afghanistan and elsewhere, and I'd be happy to post things on my website as well praising them for stopping projects. I wanted to follow up, first of all, particularly with Secretary Kennedy and Mr. Dajan. Can you pronounce it for me? I apologize. Just I want to make sure I get it right.
Jahanbani,
thank you.
Silent D, thank you.
Thank you, Jahanbani. Just that General Dumford, when he testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee in April, has said that he believes it's critical that the State Department and USAID have the same authorities to cancel contracts as the Department of Defense. And he also said that expanding that authority would include non-DOD organizations makes a lot of sense. So word from the ground, and I'm hoping that you'll look at that very carefully. And also, I know Mr. Jinman has a lot of opinions and experience with this issue, so I hope that we can have this consistency across agencies when we're all working together. And it's obviously the three agencies are working together on some of these projects in Afghanistan that you've already been questioned about.
Senator, as I said, I like the Secretary of State to have all the same authorities as the Secretary of Defense.
Great. Thank you very much. And by the way, as Mr. Ginman talked about, this authority in its initial inception has allowed the department to stop contracting with certain contractors and subcontractors. So it, while I think we can do a lot more, the initial run of it has been effective, and certainly there's more we can do if we give you greater authority. I wanted to follow up, Secretary Kennedy, on some of Senator Johnson's questions. Here's what's bothering me about the attack on our consulate and the prior cable. So I also serve on the Senate Armed Services Committee. And in February of 2000 of this past year, General Dempsey as well as Secretary Panetta testified about the attack on the consulate in Benghazi before that committee. And both of them testified that they were aware of the prior cables, particularly the cable of August 16th coming from Ambassador Stevens, which described concerns about the adequacy of the security at the consulate in Benghazi. I believe you've testified that you were familiar with that cable. Is that right?
That is correct.
They said they received that information from a report from General Hamm that went up to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and then also went to the Secretary of Defense as well. And as a result of that, in fact, General Hamm approached, according to the testimony before the Armed Services Committee, actually approached the State Department asking whether the site security team from Tripoli should be extended in Benghazi. And according to the testimony before the Armed Services Committee of General Dempsey, he was told no. Are you familiar with that testimony?
My recollection was, and I just read it, I believe, I thought it was that General Hamm approached Ambassador Stevens about whether the SST should be extended in Tripoli. That's my recollection, but I would need to refresh myself by looking at the papers before.
And they had called the embassy. It's not clear who they spoke to, according to the testimony, and they were told no. I guess the question, according to the testimony before the Armed Services Committee, it's not clear who said no for the extension of site security team. Do you know that?
What I'm aware of, Senator, is that there were 16 people on the SST, 8 security people, 2 medical, 2 communications, 2 helicopter landing zone people, 2 EOD, that's 8, and then 8 security. Those, that latter 8, had worked themselves out of a job because the State Department had been had replaced them. The 8 who were security had been replaced by a combination of State Department personnel, and if I make clear, 6 of those 8 stayed on in Tripoli, in which is not
right. But my question, just so I'm clear, I just want to understand.
Yes,
there was General Hamm knew about this, reported it up his chain of command,
right.
And do you know? He said that according to Dempsey, Hamm called the embassy and said, because of obviously the cable receipt, and said, do you want to extend the site security team? Were you aware of that, and who made the decision there?
I was not aware. Okay. No, I was not aware that General Hamm had contacted
okay.
the embassy.
Well, let me ask.
I don't know who.
Well, I'll give you a copy of that testimony because I will have a follow-up question. Here's my question to you. If what troubled me was that if General Hamm, the commander of AFRICOM, reported up his chain of command a cable from the State Department about security, involving security and other issues in Benghazi, and that went to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, went to the Secretary of Defense. How is it that you, with your responsibility, given that this was a State Department, obviously our ambassador and the personnel, there were State Department personnel here, would not have reported that up your chain of command?
Because we had replaced those individuals with State Department personnel, and
but
six
but you
of
received
them had re, Six of them had remained.
It was important enough for the AFRICOM general on the ground, okay, who it wasn't his area of responsibility, it wasn't a DOD facility, that they thought a Secretary of State, a state cable, should be reported up to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, reported up to the Secretary of Defense, and even though State Department personnel were involved, you did not report it to the Secretary of State?
Because we had replaced those individuals.
But that cable said that security was not adequate there from your ambassador. You didn't think that was important enough to report to the Secretary of State?
Because we were repairing or fixing the shortfalls that were outlined.
I'm shocked that the general in AFRICOM thought it was important enough to report it up his chain of command, even though it didn't involve his personnel directly, and you did not.
But again, Senator, two things. One, we are talking about Tripoli, not Benghazi. The tragedy took place in Benghazi. The SST was a Tripoli-based unit. So they're two separate things.
Okay. Well, my time is up, but the August cable clearly involved Benghazi, not Tripoli.
No question. But there was no offer. There was no offer or request from the post to keep the SST and shift them to Benghazi.
But we're talking about reporting up on a cable on the security of State Department personnel. So that's my issue with it. But my time is up, and I appreciate your being here.
I'm going to try to get back to contracting. Let's go to Section 853, past performance. I know that OMB has set a 100% reporting goal for 2015. As you all know, this is a section that requires the FAR Council, chaired by the Administrator of Federal Procurement Policy, to have a strategy on past performance indicators, which has really been a problem in this area. What is the current level of past performance reporting for each of you? Let's start with AID. What is your current level of past performing? What percentage do you think that you are reaching right now, and what is your goal for this year and next year?
Madam Chair, this is a number one priority for myself. Back in 2010, the percentage was 7%. Since 2011, we've put a very aggressive strategy in place, which has doubled the number to close to 30%. We are about 27% right now. And as the end of the fiscal year comes to a close, a lot of those reports will be coming in. So that percentage will go up. And we do have we've set aside November for the past performance month. And we will have another stand down day to make sure we achieve the 65%, well on our way to the 100% in calendar year 2015.
I appreciate the effort you're making with your stand-down days, and it's going to take some of that. Mr. Genman and Mr. Kennedy, are either one of you scheduling the same kind of stand-down days or using any other techniques to get us up to snuff on past performance reporting?
We are not using stand-down days. We are using directed orders to the people to get this in the days. We have also started out, and I will fully admit, from a pathetic base. We've doubled that. The last snapshot we took and just is about 17%. But just as my colleague from AID said, the data flows in at the end of the fiscal year as you're closing out contracts. We believe that we will be 45 or 50% at the end of this fiscal year.
Well, I hope that all of you can get to 50%. And you guys have better news, right, Mr. Genman?
Well, we're closer to 80%.
I know. You're doing really well.
To get to 100, that's still a challenge.
It is a challenge.
I issue a quarterly letter to all of the services and agencies that report it. We discuss it. Mr. Kendall hosts it's about a once-a-month business SIG, and we report there as well. Each of the service acquisition executives, Mr. Stackley, now Mr. LaPlante, and Ms. Hsu, all understand where they're at and push it. I'm embarrassed to say that I discovered yesterday my own office is delinquent on four CPARS reports.
That's embarrassing.
It's
good for you for admitting it.
It is.
Points for that. Let's go to noncompliance in Section 862. Mr. Chinman, have you completed your report under 862 on implementing uniform contract writing systems, which was due earlier this month?
The report is written. I believe it was released out of the building. I'm just not certain.
Okay. I want to make sure we get that for the record for this hearing. Let me ask about 802, pass-through contracts. This is obviously a big problem. We all know it's a big problem. What this basically we're trying to do is we're trying to make sure that we don't have somebody who is passing through more than 70% of the work they've contracted to do. There is a pending FAR rule that the agency would put forth. Do any of you have anything you want to put in the record about the pending rule and whether or not there are problems with it, and anything you want to address on pass-through contracts today?
Madam Chair, if I may, I would like to just mention that that I've gone ahead and issued a new policy directive to all of our contracting officers implementing this right now. Once the rule is effective, we'll rescind that and, of course, follow the FAR rule.
Okay. And what about Section 843? This requires the SECDEF to establish a chain of authority for policy planning and execution of contract support. And part of this is that when I began realizing how bad this was, there was no way you could find somebody who was responsible. I mean, it was so disparate, and so there were so many tentacles of all of this based on, and I know we've got Sticky now and other things, but do you feel like that you are getting at the operational contract support? Do you think you're getting there?
Yes, ma'am. So if I could, for just your last question, I am told it is still in coordination, so the report has not left the building.
Okay, well, we got 30 days, so that means somebody needs to just hurry up and review it and get it done and get it out.
Yes. I refer to this, and I've heard you in earlier hearings, I refer to this as the who's in charge question.
Exactly.
I believe, one, DOD Directive 3020.49, this is a mouthful. Orchestrating, synchronizing, integrating program management, a contingency acquisition plan, and its operational execution lays out clearly who's in charge and what each of the individual roles are and what it is they do.
Who's in charge at the top? Who is the person?
Well,
at the top?
So at the end of the day, within the department, the one person that everybody goes to is Secretary Hagel.
I
understand. But it's the you have the Undersecretary of Personnel and Readiness who has very distinct responsibilities when it comes to managing the force, of which contractors are a piece. Within the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition Technology and Logistics, very clear responsibilities.
Mr. Kendall,
when it comes expressly to those issues associated with acquisition and contracting and the management of contractors on the battlefield. We've got the comptroller who has very clear responsibilities associated with the money and funding and what are we doing with it. The Undersecretary of Defense for Policy has very clear responsibilities, again, with how we do this. So when to the question with risk assessments analysis, we are all engaged in that. The Joint Staff plays a significant role in how we do all of this.
Well, this investigation is going to be really interesting on this building in Leatherneck, yeah. Because what it's going to do is maybe it's going to answer that question.
It may. In fact.
And because it doesn't appear that, I mean, I get what you're saying. I know you can't just say, okay, this is the contracting poobah over here, and if anything goes wrong, it's his head, but or her head. But I want to, what I don't want to get to is just a new bunch of jargon replacing the old jargon that was very not clear. So.
So if I could, I mentioned the action plan, the OCS FCIB that was put together, that's co-chaired by Mr. Motzik, who's the Assistant Secretary of Defense LM&R Program Support, and by Brigadier General Crenshaw, who's the Deputy J4. The 10 capability areas that are addressed, the first one, And from my standpoint, the most important one is the getting the it's not the policy, it's the doctrine, and getting it so that the people, everybody understands what it is. When you go back to the Gansler Commission, in 2007. It's the professional training, it's the execution, it's the exercises.
And I know you have a joint exercise scheduled for
January.
And I know you've gone from 48 people being trained 4 years ago to over 400 trained now. I am aware that we have really, in the Corps now, I mean, when I started this, that was, you know, the low man on the totem pole was handed a clipboard and said, it doesn't really matter, just this is your job. I know we have done a lot of good work on this.
Yes. So there are just the magnitude and the size of the number of personnel, both civilian and military, and, you know, from second lieutenants and first lieutenants to senior enlisted all the way up through general officers, getting that inculcated in. I mean, we're encouraged when both General Petraeus and General Allen sign letters out that say contracting is the commander's business. I mean, for 100,000 people on a battlefield and who's managing them and overseeing where this goes, it's the getting that so that it's understood is by far and away the largest gap that we have.
Right.
It is one that we're actively working, but it is not one that we are going to solve today or tomorrow. I mean, I think we've made significant strides. Ma'am, we have a long ways to go.
Yes, you do. And I'll be here making sure that we get it done. And I'm sure Senator Johnson joins me in that. I'm way over time. I did not get a chance to get to, and we're going to have to go to a vote here. And certainly we can hold the panel for as long as you'd like if you want to do more questions. I have some specific questions for you on your remote monitoring project. I mean, this is all kinds of bells and whistles going off. The notion that we're hiring contractors to oversee the contractors is just always a really dicey proposition. And I know it's a dangerous area, but I've got some specific questions about the fact that MSI Worldwide is hiring people on this when the RFP hasn't even been completed. That seems weird to me. And I need to have some specific answers to that. So, you know, if the RFP is not out, and a contractor is already hiring people under it, that means something's rotten.
I just have one quick question, maybe not quick, but it's just one. We're looking at the Afghan Special Mission Wing, some reports on that. My concern is this is going to be the aircraft version of a $34 million building. We've already spent about $122 million. I guess projected spending is about $772 million. It's looking like there are aircraft that Afghans are not going to be able to operate effectively. Contracts being let out to a Russian contractor that has been actually barred from providing that, but they were able to continue the contracts because it was 2012 spending versus 2013. Mr. Jim, can you please address the Afghan Special Mission Wing?
Well, it's a little out of my personal area, but I believe that the letter that the Deputy Secretary sent over, one, acknowledged that the MI-17s were being bought with 2012 money, but also went on to say, if they would be bought with 2013 money, I would have signed the waiver. I think that's what the Deputy Secretary said in his letter that came over identifying it.
Is this being actively reviewed? Is this project being actively reviewed, and is there any chance of stopping it? And who is actively reviewing it? Under whose command is this?
Well, so the MI-17, the requirement for MI-17s comes through the CSTCA NTMA from the theater to a requirement. It has been thoroughly reviewed inside the department. The decision clearly was made and went up to the Deputy Secretary, and I mean, I think his letter articulates this is exactly what I found and what I did. I mean, significant time and effort was put into the decision associated with MI-17s.
So has the decision already been made, or does it continue to be reviewed?
Well,
are we going to spend the $772 million?
I think the continuing to review is, the department continues to spend significant time ensuring that we will have an adequate throughput of pilots to be able to fly the MI-17s, that we've got the skill set. It gets reviewed regularly at the warfighter SIG, that's led by the Deputy Secretary.
Okay. Well, thank you. That's all I have, Madam Chair.
I thank all of you for being here. I appreciate it very much. I know everyone's working hard on this, and there is a difference in attitude about it. I think everyone now recognizes that contracting has to be a core competency for all of you because of the reliance we have on them. We will look forward to some of the specific answers we've asked for. I'll look forward to hearing those projects that have been stopped based on sustainability and risk, and congratulating you on my website once I get those great stories of success. Thank you, and this hearing is adjourned.